Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Pope prays for Congress. Pope Benedict urges prayers for the fruits of the International Eucharistic Congress currently underway in Dublin, describing it as a precious opportunity to reaffirm the centrality of the Eucharist in the life of the Church. Congress update and testimony. The papal legate to the Congress meets survivors of abuse in Ireland, and we speak to a South African cardinal and a British bishop about the Congress's proceedings. And counting the cost of Colombia's conflict. The head of Caritas Colombia speaks of the mass suffering caused by over 40 years of internal conflict in his homeland, including the world's largest displacement of people. Benedict urged prayers for the success of the International Eucharistic Congress currently underway in Dublin, Ireland. Speaking at his Wednesday General Audience, the Pope described the Congress as a precious opportunity to reaffirm the centrality of the Eucharist in the life of the Church. Chris Altieri reports.
At this time, said Pope Benedict, our thoughts and prayers are with all those taking part in the International Eucharistic Congress.
I invite all of you to join me in praying that the Congress will bear rich spiritual fruit in a great appreciation of our Lord's gift of himself to us in the Eucharist and a deeper love of the mystery of the Church, which draws us into ever fuller communion with him and with one another through the daily celebration of the Eucharistic sacrifice.
The Holy Father's salute to the Congress and those participating in it came at the end of his weekly general audience, during which he continued his catechetical series on prayer in the writings of St. Paul the Apostle. The principal focus of the Pope's remarks this Wednesday was the Apostle's testimony to his own experience of contemplative prayer.
Defending the legitimacy of his apostolate, Paul appeals above all to his profound closeness to the Lord in prayer, marked by moments of ecstasy, visions, and revelations. Yet he speaks too of a trial which the Lord sent him, lest we become conceited, a mysterious thorn in the flesh. Paul therefore willingly boasts of his weakness in order that the power of Christ might dwell in him.
Pope Benedict went on to say that through this experience of mystical prayer, Paul realized that God's kingdom comes about not by our own efforts, but by the power of God's grace shining through our poor earthen vessels.
We see that the contemplative prayer is both exalting and troubling, since we experience both the beauty of God's love and the sense of our own weakness. Paul teaches us the need for daily perseverance in prayer, even at times of dryness and difficulty, for it is there that we experience the life-changing power of God's love.
Following the catechesis, the Holy Father had greetings in many languages, including English, in which he welcomed pilgrims and visitors who were taking part in various international gatherings underway in Rome this week.
I am pleased to greet the participants in the 21st Intercoiffure World Congress. I also welcome the visitors from the Anglican Diocese of Southwark. My cordial greetings goes to the pilgrims from the Catholic Society of the Two Hearts of Jesus and Mary. I thank the cantores minores from Finland and the other choirs for the praise of God in song.
Pope Benedict concluded his English remarks with a blessing.
Upon all the English-speaking pilgrims and visitors present to this audience, including those from England, New Zealand, Samoa, and the United States, and invoke God's blessings of joy and peace.
The Holy Father's blessing followed his appeal for the International Eucharistic Congress underway in Dublin, Ireland this week. The Congress opened on Sunday, June 10th, and runs through Sunday, June 17th. I'm Chris Altieri.
The papal legate to the International Eucharistic Congress, Cardinal Marc Ouellet, has met with a group of victims of abuse in the Irish Church. This included representatives of institutional and clerical abuse, men and women, from both North and South Ireland. Wednesday's meeting lasted 2 hours, during which each survivor spoke of his or her own personal experience of abuse and its impact on their lives. The meeting took place on the island and sanctuary of Lough Derg, where the papal legate had gone on a pilgrimage of penance at the express request of Pope Benedict. After the meeting with the abuse victims, Cardinal Uile celebrated Mass in St. Patrick's Basilica on the island, and in his homily apologised once again for this grave sin and tragedy, saying it is a source of great shame and enormous scandal. He went on to reaffirm the Church's commitment to creating a safe environment for children. Thousands of Catholics from across the world are attending the week-long Eucharistic Congress being held in the Irish capital, whose overall theme is the Eucharist, communion with Christ and with one another. Among the participants at the week-long event is Cardinal Wilfrid Napier of Durban in South Africa. Emma McCarthy asked him for his impressions of the Congress so far.
I came here in order to express my solidarity with the Irish Church. I was trained here, a lot of my training as a Franciscan was done in this country, and I feel a close affinity to Ireland. I've suffered a lot, I think, as the shortcomings have been publicised and over-publicised. So it was a way of coming and saying, just as Jesus, just before he suffered. So I'm hoping that the Church in Ireland, in the suffering, is going to bring the gift of the Eucharist back into the lives of the people.
It's quite a big representation from African nations here. We've seen pilgrims from Angola. I saw a huge delegation from Zimbabwe who had made their own costumes for this Eucharistic Congress. So there is a great participation of the Universal Church. How important do you think this is for the Irish faith? And have you had a chance to speak to anyone from the Irish Church so far?
Not immediately. So just some confreres, the Franciscan confreres. I sense there's a couple of things about the response in Ireland. There's a certain cynicism. It's not the right time to have it. There's a certain almost hopelessness. It's gone so far, can it actually be turned around? At the same time, I think there's a quiet, relief. It's taking place, but there's a growing confidence and a trust that this is going to be the start of a new healing process. That's what I'm picking up. It's only early days yet, but I'm picking that up as well.
What interventions have you had a chance to hear? And since Saturday to today, what has stuck out most in your mind from this Congress?
I think the Mass on Sunday would certainly have to be the major point. I think it's the most joyful celebration. The lead-up to it, the involvement of young people, the choirs, I think was absolutely wonderful for setting a tone. It is a tone of celebration. And certainly the beginning, right from the beginning, the apology, the stone with the prayer, I think all these things are really not hiding away from the problems or hiding the problems away, but certainly making sure that we are speaking within a context, we're praying within a context, and especially reflecting and deciding on actions within that context.
The Congress's theme for the day on Wednesday was Priesthood and Ministry. Mark Davis is the Bishop of Shrewsbury in England, and on Monday night drew a crowd of thousands of people when he was asked to give the first catechesis for young people at the Congress. He spoke to Emma McCarthy about his intervention and the need and desire to promote new religious vocations.
We're very much on the model of World Youth Day, which Blessed John Paul II provided for us. I was asked to give the first catechesis for the young people, for the youth of this Congress in Dublin. And I was very struck, as I think many people were, by both the response in numbers of young people, but also their responsiveness and attentiveness to the catechesis, the doctrine that we were sharing with them, and my wish to encourage them to make that promise which Pope Benedict asked for 7 years ago in Cologne, that they would remain faithful to the Sunday Mass.
Afterwards, the young people also had the opportunity to speak to you, so it wasn't necessarily just, you know, a bishop standing there and preaching to the young people. It was very interactive. Can you take us through the main questions that the young people brought up?
I think that dialogue, as you say, is tremendously important, and the ability to have that conversation. What I was very struck with was the positive character of the questions and comments from the young people. They were asking about their involvement and how they should be involved in the life of the church. They were asking about how they can give witness and the importance of good example. So the questions we got back at the Dublin Congress, which I received as a bishop here, was very much a desire about how in their young lives they can engage and be witnesses. And I don't think we could have had a better response.
In fact, the vast majority were actually, although there were foreign pilgrims here, but however, the vast majority last night were young Irish people, many from that category, that age group, who, while they grew up in the shadow of the sexual abuse crisis, weren't directly involved. Would you agree that they seem to have a certain hunger that's not being fulfilled yet? They really are hungry to know about their faith, but perhaps the Irish Church is so caught up with other challenges that, to a certain extent, it's overlooked the resource and hunger of the young people here.
I think that's a universal phenomenon, which I think Blessed John Paul showed us. But I think that could be true, that there is that specific longing to hear again the positive message of the gospel, the great news of our faith, and to share that again. They are aware of the shadows that are there of our sinful, fallen human condition, and perhaps as a generation more acutely aware in some ways of that. But what they want to hear is the authentic message. And last night, I think, showed us with the best part of 1,000 young people, they estimated, that came to catechesis, that that desire is very much here.
On a completely separate issue, I won't keep you too long, but we do know that there is going to be the pilgrimage of the relics of St. John Jean-Marie Vianney that you're involved in. Can you take us through this initiative?
Yes, it's an initiative which, again, I would attribute to Blessed John Paul II and to our Holy Father Pope Benedict, who raised up the figure of this very simple, ordinary parish priest. And I asked the Bishop of Belliards whether it would be possible for the relic of St. John Vianney of his heart to come to England to be an occasion to pray for the renewal of the Catholic priesthood and also for the renewal of the true life of our parishes. So it's with those intentions and also that desire to promote new vocations for the future to the priesthood that the relic will come at the beginning of July, the beginning of next month, to make this pilgrimage in England.
Some people might say, are you mad? In this day and age when vocations is on the decline, it's constantly pessimistic speech we're hearing from all circles, be it secular and even within the church itself. However, Wednesday here at the Congress is also focusing on the theme of communion and priesthood. And we know that for St. Jean-Marie Vianney, Eucharistic adoration was of extreme importance.
Of great importance. That's something we'll be promoting during the visit. And I think in response to that scene of difficulty and contention, both with the world and sometimes with voices discordant within the church, the importance of the saints appears more and more for us. And the saint of priests, the saint of parishes, who is St. John Mary Vianney, has a special importance. And he takes us to where he began his mission in ours, where he began each day, at the foot of the tabernacle, there before the Lord, who is truly with us in the Eucharist, who gives himself for us in the sacrifice of the Mass. It is there that he will lead us. And it's there, ultimately, that all the saints lead us. So that's my great hope, that during the few days of this English visit, but also for the future of the church, that we will allow the saints so to lead us to the heart of our faith.
Among the many volunteers who were actively involved in the preparation for the Congress is Luc Janssen, a Dutch-born Dominican friar who was raised as a non-believer and knew little about God until his mid-20s. In the run-up to the Congress, he spoke to my colleague Emma McCarthy about his radical faith journey and how he came to discern his religious vocation.
I was only baptized 9 years ago, and initially, when I was brought up, there wasn't much mention of God at all in my life. So I didn't really know about God, and I think that is the situation, definitely becoming more and more the situation in a lot of the Western world, where people are growing up. The family might not be practicing Catholics or practicing Christians. They might not go to church, and at school you don't really learn anything about God either. So it was only when I was in my early 20s, when I happened, more or less by accident, to come to Ireland to finish my studies, that I came in contact with somebody who challenged me, I suppose, on my unbelief in God. And initially, when we started talking, I thought, like, this is going to be an easy conversation, because I'm just going to say that the Big Bang Theory solved everything and that evolution shows how life started. But then when we start to probe a bit deeper into the issues, and I did a bit of reading and we did a good bit of discussing, I discovered that it wasn't as simple as that. And there was a moment that I realized that the existence of a God is a much more probable explanation of the existence of everything around us than to believe in nothing. And my friend at that stage, he advised me to say a few prayers, maybe 5 minutes a day, and to start reading the New Testament, beginning with the Gospels. And he said it might take a few weeks, it wouldn't be an instant revelation mostly, but I must say that I kind of experienced that God was real quite soon after doing that, and everything just kind of started to make sense once I discovered that this God is actually a personal God who you can actually know. And that kind of completely turned my life upside down, I suppose.
That was Dominican friar Brother Luke Jansen speaking to my colleague, Emma McCarthy. And earlier you heard the voices of UK Bishop Mark Davis and South African Cardinal Wilfred Napier. It's an armed conflict that has caused the world's largest displacement crisis, with 5.2 million people forced to flee their homes since 1985. Of these people, 97% live below the poverty line. In case you're wondering, I'm not talking about the Congo or another well-known world trouble spot, but instead about the little reported situation in Colombia. Over 40 years of internal armed conflict in Colombia have caused mass suffering for its people. But despite the scale of the conflict, the Latin American nation's troubles have been largely overlooked by the world's media. The Catholic Church has been actively involved in efforts to hold peace negotiations with all parties to Colombia's conflict. It seeks to defend human rights and provides assistance to victims of the conflict. At the forefront of these efforts is Caritas Colombia, that works with communities affected by the violence, helping them to secure their rights to ancestral land from which they have been displaced by armed groups. Its director is Monsignor Hector Henao, who has been visiting several European Union nations to lobby governments to ensure that foreign companies, especially mining concerns, do not profit from land seized from Colombian peasants. Monsignor Henao is also urging EU nations to put pressure on the Bogotá government to speed up progress in the field of land restitution. He spoke to me during his recent visit to Britain about these and other issues related to the legacy of Colombia's long-running conflict. He began by telling me who are the main victims of land seizure in his homeland.
Well, the victims in this case are poor peasants. We have also indigenous population and the Afro-Colombians. They have suffered internal displacement since many years ago due to internal armed conflict in Colombia. When they were displaced, they also lost all their properties, in particular land. At the moment, we have a big opportunity because last year, the Colombian government signed a law on victims and land restitution to give back them their rights and also to give them the opportunity to get again their land. The process at the moment is starting And we hope that in the future, many, many people will apply in the framework of this law to have the restitution of their land.
So roughly, how many poor peasants have lost their land? What kind of numbers are we talking about?
If we speak about the last 20 years, we are speaking about more than 4 million internally displaced population. There are different statistics. Sometimes NGOs have different numbers. But in general, we can speak about 4 million people that lose 6 million hectares all around the country.
So a very big number. Your visit to the UK coincides with the first anniversary of the UN adopting guiding principles on business and human rights. What examples can you provide from Colombia which show instances where businesses have violated or not respected human rights as a result of their business activities?
Well, the most important cases are related to mining, because some of the international companies, they started to work in their territories some years ago, and they didn't properly speak in the previous consultation. So that is one of our concerns, how the population being consulted, and if when during the process of consultation they got the opportunity to listen to the whole community, not just some people, but the whole community. That's one. And on the other cases is related to prevent abuses. Some of the international companies are trying to work in territories where the armed conflict is still going on. They have to prevent that the illegal groups will attack the civil population or will make pressure on the peasants.
You talked about mining, and the UK, of course, is among the Western countries who have mining interests. What kind of response have you received from the UK government on this particular issue?
The government in the United Kingdom, they are doing the steps to incorporate the principles into the law. They say that they are very, very committed. But in particular, I want to speak about UK embassy in Bogota. The ambassador has worked very hard with the different organizations of the civil society and the international British companies based in Bogota, in Colombia, in order to implement the guiding principles. In my opinion, this is a good example for other members of the international community and for other companies. They are speaking about prevention, they are speaking about restitution for the communities who suffer damages.
Staying on the subject of mining, what kind of environmental pollution is the mining causing? I mean, is it really putting at risk the health of the population in that area or the people who work in the mines?
Well, most of the problems when we speak about mining is related to water. In many cases, they destroy the water sources or they mix the water with different waste they have during the process. So the water at the end is one of the biggest concerns for the local communities. On the other hand, there are other issues related to the environment because it's the destruction of the land itself.
Now, we've just seen very recently, in recent days, the release of foreign hostages. And there have been some signs that the FARC guerrillas may be prepared to enter into negotiations with the government on some issues. How likely do you think this is?
Well, look, this liberation could be a good step toward peace and reconciliation. Our bishop conference are very, very committed to encourage the government and to encourage also the illegal groups to have negotiations on humanitarian issues, but to finalize also the armed internal conflict. Seems to be that something is starting again. Contacts, conversations, and many people want to support. For the church, we have three different points. One point is the humanitarian issues, child soldiers, kidnapped people, internal displacement. On the other hand, we have all the problems related to the guarantees for the communities living in the areas affected by the armed conflict, because negotiation could give a new opportunity for that communities and could support more their development. And the last point is the conversations itself and the real will and the real commitment to achieve peace in Colombia, which we consider today is possible, and we have a lot of hope on that.
You yourself in the past have helped secure the release of foreign hostages held by a guerrilla group and had to spend several months in London after threats were made against your life. Have you often received such threats, and how worried are you by them, and who do you believe is responsible?
Well, at the moment, I think the situation for me is different. I continue to be working at the Bishop Conference. Some of the people working for social ministry, I mean for our office, Caritas, they have received threats in the rural areas. Local directors of Caritas have been also killed during those two decades. I think the most important for us is do not leave the people alone, to continue to be with the population, and on the other hand, to continue to speak in favor of, because our message is not against someone or somebody, but is in favor of peace, justice and reconciliation.
The Colombian bishops are meeting with Pope Benedict and other Vatican officials this week. What do you think are likely to be the issues at the top of the agenda?
Well, I think issues related to peace could be part of the agenda. They will explain to the Holy Father how the situation is going in Colombia. And as the Holy Father several times has prayed for the situation of the victims and invited the international community to support the people suffering in Colombia, that could be another important issue. We know how the Holy Father is committed to the poor, the people, victims of the war. So the Colombian bishops will invite him to continue to support that population, and will be a big opportunity also for the bishop of our conference to show the Holy Father how the church in Colombia is committed and what is doing at the moment in those fields.
Finally, just one last question. How do you see the future of your country? Are you hopeful, as you said earlier, that there could be a halt or at least a lessening of the armed conflict?
I'm hopeful. I think in Colombia we have two or three reasons to be hopeful. On one hand, the population, in particular the people living in the rural areas, they are committed, even if they have suffered a lot during the armed internal conflict, is people thinking and having initiatives on local peace, which is very important. Second, I think the civil society in Colombia is playing a good role also on human rights and peace. And the last is this opening from the government and from the illegal groups to start negotiations. They are speaking more and more on how they think will be the conditions, or how they think will be the possibilities to have a new approach and a new negotiation. So I think Colombia could start again the way to achieve peace, and we pray the Lord to accompany our people in that role.
I was speaking to Monsignor Hector Henao, Director of Caritas Colombia. Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we hope you have enjoyed listening to us. We'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes at the click of a mouse on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.